Okay. Well, since all of you spent all of spring break listening to my recordings, you should be in really good shape for this week's examination. All we need to do is get through a final chapter, and probably most of this chapter will be new to most of you because I don't... Actually, been a while since I taught 181, but I'm thinking that you don't get most of this in 181. If you took 201, Human Anatomy and Physiology, you've had this. Anyway, this chapter is about cell movement, including both motility and contractility. Motility refers to getting a cell from A to B. Moving for a single cell organism, for instance, motility is how it gets around. A sperm, for instance, is a motile cell. It is able to locomote because it has a flagellum. So that's one type of cell movement. But there's also cell movement intracellularly. Things are moving around intracellularly. And that usually involves some sort of pulling on things. And that's what contractility refers to. This is how your muscles work, but it's more than just muscle cells that contract. Eukaryotic cells are able to undergo quite a bit of shape change because of interaction between cytoskeletal elements and other proteins that act as little motors. And in this first slide, we're looking at two major categories of motor proteins. We've used the word motor protein before, just as a general phrase, but there are two major ways that these motor proteins work, either by interacting with microtubules, which is why in the first major group are the microtubule-associated motors, or by interacting with microfilaments. So there are microfilament-associated motors as well. And you can see under each of these lists that there are several different ones. Actually, the microtubule-associated motors come in two major subcategories, each of which is full of many examples. So there are what are called dynions and kinesins. Those are both microtubule-associated motor proteins because they interact with microtubules as part of the cytoskeleton. But there are several different kinds of dynions and several different kinds of kinesins, especially kinesins. There are two major categories of dynions, but there's more than two kinds. These are just categories of dynions. Cytoplasmic ones, as you see, and axonemal. Remember when we talked about the cytoskeleton in general, that when we talked about microtubules, we said that there are cytoplasmic microtubules and there are axonemal microtubules. Well, an axoneme is an arrangement of microtubules in a flagellum or a cilium. And both of those structures can be used for cell motility. Now, if it's a unicellular, well, I'll talk more about that in a minute. But anyway, the cytoplasmic dynions are associated with obviously the cytoplasmic microtubules. Remember that throughout the cytoplasm you have an arrangement of microtubules and that those operate as little roadways. So these cytoplasmic dynions have the job of moving things around along these microtubules from one place in a cell to another. Now kinesins do that as well, and there are many different kinds of kinesins. This is not an exhaustive list. But what they have in common is that most kinesins move things on the microtubules in one direction, and dynions move them along the same kinds of microtubules, but in the opposite direction. So functionally speaking, most kinesins and dynions are opposites. A microtubule can be thought of as a two-way street, but you're only allowed to go one way at a time. If you're you know, it's not that they have lanes, but the microtubules have directionality to them because they're polar, right? There's a plus end and a minus end. Well, notice that the dynions move cargo toward the minus end of the microtubules. And I think all known dynions move toward the minus. Whereas most kinesins, although there are a couple exceptions, move them toward the plus end. All right? Now, microfilament-associated motors do a similar thing. They interact. They are proteins that interact with the cytoskeleton, but they interact with the microfilaments instead. And how these operate is more complex, and so we're going to spend more time on that. That's how your muscles work, for instance. It's not the only thing they're involved with, though. Anyway, those are the major categories. In slide 2, we're looking at an electron micrograph of a vesicle, which is the cargo, moving along a microtubule via motor proteins. And so the little cartoon that you see with a vesicle walking with a motor protein one step at a time along a microtubule is not just a cartoon. That's really how they are shaped. This one happens to be in an axon. It's not the only place this happens. It happens in any kind of eukaryotic cell. But in an axon, it's especially important because you have this long axon of a neuron cell body at the other end. That's where all the proteins are made. Well, the proteins need to be delivered to the other end of the axon, so they get moved along microtubules using kinesins to move them in one direction. Okay, well, in 3, we can see how this is happening. So this is using kinesin 1 as an example. It's fundamentally not really any different for the different kinds of kinesins, but notice that kinesin 1 is made of 2 heavy chains and 2 light chains. So there's 4 overall polypeptides here. But the 2 heavy chains, which are the bigger ones, of course, wrap around each other and then have a globular head, or really you should call it a foot, since it's really what is stepping along the microtubule. But the globular part, the purple part, is what actually interacts with the little beads that the microtubule is made out of. The tubulin that we talked about, that's what the 2 shades of orange are. Those are alpha and beta tubulin, making up the overall microtubule. Well, the motor protein has these 2 feet that walk along it one step at a time, but the light chains at the other end are what make the connection with the thing being carried, which is typically a vesicle containing some collection of proteins or whatever else the cargo is. So most of the things involved here are proteins. The microtubules themselves are proteins, and all the parts of the motor protein, the kinesin, is protein. Plus there are proteins in the membrane of the vesicle that interact with the light chains of the kinesins. Proteins do just about every important job in cells, but they're really involved in movement of all sorts. Okay, so notice this is an active process. You don't get to move things around via motor proteins for free, just like you don't get to run your car if you don't put gas in it. So this is powered by the hydrolysis of ATP, which is not surprising. Most endergonic processes are powered by ATP hydrolysis. That's ATP hydrolysis, though, for every single step of this motor protein. And since these things are at the molecular level, you can appreciate that it's going to take a lot of steps to get down a huge axon, a long axon. It's going to take a lot of ATP to do that. Well, anyway, this is the hydrolysis of ATP doesn't occur immediately. So notice that ATP will come in and bind to this leading edge, this leading foot. All right, that's going to cause a shape change that will swing the other foot that's now in the back of it into the front. And notice that that one has an ADP attached to it. Not because ADP came in to attach to it, but because the ATP that earlier attached to it has now been hydrolyzed. And so it pops off. The ADP, well, the shape change that's caused swings this thing around, and then the ADP pops off in the inorganic phosphate of the ATP that's now in the back, pops off, leaving ADP behind. Now a new ATP can come into the one that's now on the front, and that's going to swing this rear one to the front again, and it just continues cyclically for however long the ride needs to be to get it from wherever to where it's going, wherever that is. So that's basically how kinesins and dynions both work. They're not the same proteins, of course. In fact, there are different kinds of kinesins and different kinds of dynions. But that's basically how they work, by stepping along microtubules at the expense of ATP. And fundamentally, as we see in slide 4, what I said was that kinesins move things along microtubules toward the plus end, whereas dynions move them toward the minus end, with a couple exceptions for some of the kinesins. There's at least one kinesin that they discovered is bidirectional, but most of them move them toward the plus end. Dynions move them toward the minus. And recall that microtubules are not just randomly occurring in the cytoskeleton. They grow in length, the microtubules, remember, grow in length from the microtubule organizing center. And the microtubule organizing center is where the minus ends of all of these microtubules are. So that means, since the microtubule organizing center is roughly in the middle of the cell, that dynions, which move always toward the minus end, are moving things in a retrograde manner, away from the edge of the cell toward the center, toward the microtubule organizing center. Whereas kinesins are moving things in an anterograde direction, away from the center, out toward the periphery, or the edge of the cell. Now, if this is an animal cell, what do we find in the microtubule organizing center? Centrioles, right, which you can see here. But what is the microtubule organizing center itself called? Whether it's an animal cell or not, if it's just eukaryotic of any type, what do we call the microtubule organizing center? Centrosome, correct. So the centrosome is this kind of amorphous halo that you see here. And that's all that you would have in a plant, for instance, just that region, because it wouldn't have centrioles. But the centrioles are there in an animal cell. Like I said, we haven't really figured out why they are necessary, but they're there. Okay. Now to 5. In 5, we're looking at cilia on the top and a flagellum on the bottom. Cilia is a plural of cilium. Cilium means literally hair. Now, it's of course not hair like mammals make. It's different stuff. But it looks like a hair coming out of the surface of a cell that is ciliated. Well, cilia are eukaryotic cell processes that are made up of microtubules and other proteins to give them their shape and also to give them their ability to beat. Cilia are named for their hair-like appearance, but unlike hair, they move around quite a bit. They sweep back and forth. The big difference between a cilium and a flagellum is really the number that occur on a cell and the size. They're organized much the same at the molecular level as far as the microtubules are concerned, but a flagellum is much longer than a cilium. And if a cell is ciliated, it's going to have many cilia on it, not just one. It could be the entire surface of the cell, or it could be one side of it, depending on where it is. Whereas a flagellated cell typically has one to three flagella at one end of the cell. And so a flagellum is really always about propelling the cell. This is a free living cell that can move around within its medium. And a flagellum just acts like a whip-like tail that will push it through that medium. Now, if you have a free living cell that is ciliated, cilia can also propel. By beating, the cilia can move the cell from A to B. But in a multicellular organism, which of course has multiple cells, a ciliated cell might be held in place with respect to other cells of the body, for instance. And therefore, the beating of the cilia isn't really about propelling the cell through the medium. Rather, it's about moving the medium past the surface of the cell. Just like you have happening continuously throughout your lifetime in your throat. Or in the tracheal lining, your airway to your lungs. That's a mucus surface, so it's producing mucus. But those cells are also ciliated, continuously beating. Well, the mucus is sticky, so debris that you breathe in and don't really want to reach your lung surface, the debris sticks there, and then the beating of the cilia move it backwards, away from the lungs, up toward your throat, where you continuously swallow it. It's a good thing to swallow it because that puts it into the most inhospitable place in your body as far as other things living in you, which is your stomach. The acidity will take care of. Most things can't survive the stomach. Okay, so see the difference? Cilia can move either the medium past a stationary cell, or it can move a cell through the medium. A flagellum, though, moves the cell through the medium. If we look at the arrangement of these microtubules in slide 6, you can see what is called a so-called 9+2 arrangement in the axoneme, which is this little bundle that makes up either a cilium or a flagellum. And this is the 9+2, that name comes from the fact that what you have are 9 doublets encircling 2 singlets. Remember that we talked about doublets and singlets? No, you don't? Okay, well, thanks for admitting that. A singlet is just in cross-section, it's just one circle. Okay? A doublet is a complete circle and then a semicircle connected to it. They share a wall. So that's a doublet. And you even have triplets in some cases, like right here. These are triplets. But that's why I say it's a 9+2 arrangement. You have 9 doublets peripherally, and then in the middle, 2 singlets, also called the central pair, and then a whole system of other proteins holding it all together. Now, when that's the end view, if you look at it from the side, you have what's called the axoneme. And you have that in every one of the cilia of a ciliated cell. But you also have a very similar arrangement in a flagellum for a flagellated cell. Now, there are flagellated bacteria. We're talking about eukaryotes in this chapter. There are flagellated bacteria, but their flagella are totally different, completely different origin evolutionarily, uses a completely different set of proteins that operate differently too. A flagellum of a eukaryotic cell bends, so it whips back and forth. It kind of looks under a microscope, if you look at a living bacterial cell that is flagellated, that its whipping back and forth as well, but it's really spinning like a propeller. It's kind of a corkscrew shape that is spinning, so it works differently as well. But we're talking in this chapter about eukaryotic cells. Anyway, let's go to 7 and talk about how these things can bend. Now, cilia undergo... Did I not say anything about the power stroke and the recovery stroke when we were back there? Yeah, sorry about that. Let me go back to slide 5 for just a second to point out that the power stroke and the recovery stroke are different with respect to the stiffness during those strokes. In the power stroke, the cilium stays fairly rigid as it bends with respect to the main surface of the cell. Whereas the recovery stroke features bending along its length during that whole time it's coming back. Because if you had stiffness in both directions, you would just undo what you did. Just like when you use an oar in a boat, right? You don't go back and forth in the water the whole time. You have a power stroke when it's in the water, then you take it out of the water for the recovery stroke so you're not working against yourself. Well, you can't take it out of the water if you're a cilium because you're surrounded by that water. And therefore, you just make it bend so that it doesn't push on the medium on the way back. Okay, I just wanted to point that out. But anyway, what is it that makes these things bend? We're back on slide 7 now. Within the axoneme, which is made up of all of these microtubules that I was just describing, you can see these are the doublets that we've been talking about in the 9+2 arrangement. Between these doublets, though, are dynions, motor proteins that we just talked about. Microtubule-associated motor proteins. But these ones are axonemal dynions rather than cytoplasmic dynions. They still do the same thing, though, basically. They walk along microtubules. In this case, though, the other end, which would be the cargo end, is not a vesicle. It's another doublet of microtubule within that axoneme. So these dynions are walking along one microtubule and dragging another microtubule with respect to that first microtubule. In other words, it causes these microtubules to slide past each other. Or at least it would if there were nothing tethering together the microtubules. In A, we see that it's unrestrained sliding. Right? That's not really what's happening in a cilium, though. Instead, what you have are cross-links. These proteins shown by these black bars are little tethers holding the two microtubules together in an adjacent pair. Now, let me see whether I can do it. If I have two unlinked microtubules represented by these two papers, and you have dynions walking them along, there's nothing that they just slide past each other, right? But if there's a link between them, which I can simulate by putting a fold in it, now the two are linked to each other by this top fold, and you start walking them along this way, it's going to bend because of the way they're tethered. That's what these black cross-link proteins are doing. And so the dynions are doing their job of walking, but it causes a bend instead of just a sliding. All right, that's dynions and kinesins. Now we're on 8. We can talk about microfilament-associated motor proteins, which are various kinds of myosins. Now, these things are called myosin no matter what kind of cell they're in, but what does myo mean? Muscle, right. It means muscle. Muscle cells are called myofibers. So they're called that because of that. That's what they're mostly studied in. That's what we know most of about their operation in. But they occur in all kinds of eukaryotic cells, not just muscle cells. And they operate similarly even in non-muscle cells. But we really are going to pay mostly attention to this particular kind of myosin that your skeletal muscles use. Anyway, myosins have a globular head, or a pair of globular heads, because there's really multiple. These things are polymers of polymers. It's multimeric. These are multimeric proteins, just like kinesins and dynions are. So, in myosin II, which is one that we really know a lot about, as you see, there are two globular heads attached to two heavy chains that wrap around each other. The globular heads, though, whether there's one or two in whatever type of myosin you're talking about, the globular head features a binding site. And the binding site, the thing that is able to bind there, is actin. And we've already talked about actin, right? What is actin? What's it a component of? Well, it is a protein, but what is it a component of? In fact, we call them actin what? Yeah, they're microfilaments. Actin is microfilaments of the cytoskeleton. So these myosin molecules are motor proteins that interact with actin microfilaments rather than with tubulin, which are the microtubules. That's what dynein and kinesin do. That's the big difference. Okay, so that purple boxing glove-looking thing, or blue, whatever color it is, that's the part that's actually going to interact with the actin microfilament, making this thing function as a mobility protein. Okay, so let's focus on what's happening specifically in skeletal muscle. Slide 9. First of all, let's talk about the hierarchical arrangement anatomically of a skeletal muscle. A whole muscle, is something that has a name. Like in this example, biceps brachii. That's the muscle that's being indicated. That whole thing is the whole muscle. Well, that's many, many cells big. It's not a single cell, right? But it has a parallel arrangement to it. It is a bundle of bundles of bundles, really. However many cells are in the whole muscle, they all run side by side. That's what I mean by parallel arrangement. So skeletal muscle cells, compared to most cells, are unusual in that they are long. They're very long. Another example, in addition to neurons, they are long cells. And so if you look at an individual skeletal muscle cell, it runs the whole length of the whole muscle. Well, at least from one tendon of it to the other tendon of it. Okay? The reddish part is one cell long. But there are thousands and thousands of those, like fibers in a cable, running side by side in parallel. So that's the whole muscle in A. In B, we're looking at just some muscle fibers of those many more that are in A. And that's because a whole muscle is the entire thing, of course, but it is broken down into several large bundles called fascicles. And each fascicle is itself a bundle of many muscle cells. Okay? So what's being represented in B, and doesn't use the word, it just says it's a bundle of muscle fibers, that's a fascicle. Whole muscle has some number of fascicles running side by side though down its entire length. Now, I said a little bit earlier that a muscle cell can be called a muscle cell, but it can also be called a myofiber or a muscle fiber. Those all mean exactly the same thing. One cell. Myofiber, muscle fiber, muscle cell, all are interchangeable. One cell is all they mean. Okay, so a fascicle contains multiple myofibers. Well, this is just one myofiber here in, I guess it's C. This is a single cell, has its own plasma membrane, but that cell itself, inside it, has a bundled arrangement. So, subcellularly, a single myofiber is a bundle of molecules in arrangements called myofibrils. So myofibrils are smaller than a cell. There are many myofibrils running side by side within a myofiber. So this is like a complex cable that's, you know, you have tiny strands making up small bundles, which are then bundled with each other to form bigger bundles and so on. Now the myofibrils, we're looking at just one of them coming out here, and this is just part of the length of a myofibril. Myofibrils, though, are the entire length of the cell. The cell, of course, is the entire length of the cell. The fascicle is the entire length of the muscle. Okay? So all of these things are the same length. Myofibril, myofiber, fascicle, whole muscle. Those are all the same length. They're just different sizes of width because of the bundling. In a single myofibril, though, it has a serial arrangement to it as well. Serial meaning end-to-end rather than side-by-side. There's a repeating subunit that makes up a myofibril. And that repeating subunit is called a sarcomere. Sarco means flesh. And when we talk about flesh of something, we're usually talking about the skeletal muscle. So what most flesh eaters eat is the skeletal muscle of the animal. All right, so a sarcomere, there's many of them end-to-end that make up one myofibril. And there are many myofibrils side-by-side within one cell. So that means a myofibril is kind of like a freight train made up of a bunch of boxcars, end-to-end. Each of those boxcars is a sarcomere. All right? Now, when you look close up at one sarcomere, you can see that we have myosin and actin, along with other proteins, but myosin and actin are in there interacting with each other, or at least we're able to bring about a condition in which they're able to interact. They're not always interacting, otherwise your muscles would continuously be contracted. Right? But these proteins are arranged into two major kinds of filaments, thick filaments and thin filaments. Now, the thick filaments, even though they are thicker, are made out of just one kind of protein, which is myosin. It's many different myosins bundled together to make up one thick filament, but it's all myosin. The thin filaments, even though they are thinner, are actually made up of three major proteins, which we'll talk about in a second because they're not shown here. But of those three proteins, actin is one, and that's why they're called actin filaments. It's not pure actin, though, like a myosin filament is. Thick filaments are just myosin. Okay, now, let me go on to 10. And in this view, when we cut one myofibril transversely, so we have a cross-section to look at, we see the photograph in B. So this shows you that these thick filaments and these thin filaments are interlaced. They're all running in parallel, but between each other. So these are the thick filaments. These are the thin filaments. It's one after another, over and over. All right? But what we have making up the myofibril, as I said, is an end-to-end arrangement of many sarcomeres. A single sarcomere is just the distance between what are called Z-lines. So two Z-lines are the official boundary of a single sarcomere. All right? Now, for a muscle cell to contract, that means it's going to get shorter. A muscle cell contracts because myofibrils within that muscle cell contract. They do this, though, without any without any myosin filament or actin filament getting shorter itself. The reason that a sarcomere gets shorter, and therefore, since many sarcomeres end to end is a myofibril, therefore the myofibril will get shorter as well when sarcomeres individually do. The reason that a sarcomere gets shorter, though, is not because these filaments get shorter themselves, it's just that they increase their degree of overlap between each other. So, probably a better picture in this next one. Yeah. In slide 11, we have a single sarcomere. This is a Z line, this is a Z line. The Germans were the first to elucidate this thing so that they got to name them. Z lines are, Z is short for Zwischenscheibe, which is German for, Zwischen means between, but I actually forget what Scheibe means, it doesn't matter. Anyway, disc. I mean, so disc between, okay. This little part on the left is part of another sarcomere. This little part on the right, another sarcomere. But between these two Z lines, that's one sarcomere. All right? And the Z discs, as they're often called, are themselves complexes of proteins to which the thin filaments are anchored, notice. The thin filaments on the left side of the sarcomere are all anchored to one Z disc. The thin filaments on the right side of that same sarcomere are all anchored to the other Z disc. The thick filaments, which are the myosin ones, are not anchored to either Z line or Z disc. Instead, they are anchored in their middle, and the M here is for mittel, which means middle, halfway between the two Z discs. So both kinds of microfilaments here, actin and myosin, are held in place. But notice that they overlap each other. And this is what makes the difference when we talk about these other alphabetic descriptions. The M line is right in the middle. The H zone, H for hell, meaning clear, right? Is that right? Clear? Hell, clear?
Hell is light.
Okay. So, a lot of this has to do with the way light is treated when you shine it onto these molecular structures. Anyway, the H zone is defined as just the region on either side of the M line where all you have is myosin. You don't have thin. You have thick only, not thin. See that? Okay, the I band, you don't have an I band within a sarcomere. An I band is centered on a Z disc. So half of the I band is in one sarcomere, half is in the other. But it's kind of the opposite of the H zone because the I band, the I here stands for isotropic. It's one way of dealing with the light. The I band has only thin filaments, not thick at all. You see that? Okay, then you have the A band, which is also centered on the M line, but the A band includes the entire length of the myosin, the thick filament. Okay. Now the way this thing contracts is what, like I said, or I started to say minutes ago, is not by the myosin getting shorter or the actin getting shorter. Instead, they increase their amount of overlap with each other. So it's not a perfect analogy, but I can use my fingers. My thumbs represent the two Z discs of a sarcomere, right? And so if I overlap my fingers like this more and more, I'm actually getting this sarcomere shorter. But my fingers are not changing their length. They're just increasing their overlap more. That's what's happening in muscular contraction. Myosin heads, which are the parts of these myosin thick filaments that actually interact with the actin of the thin filaments, walk just like kinesins or dynions, in a sense, down the length of a thin filament. And when they do that, what they're really, instead of the myosin actually walking along it, what it's really doing is dragging the actin toward the center. And it's doing the same thing at the other end, but in the opposite direction. And since the thin filaments are anchored to the Z-discs, that means the Z-discs are going to approach each other. They're being dragged toward the center. And the overall sarcomere, therefore, gets shorter. Now, the same. Sarcomere is a tiny thing in length, so there's not very much shortening that's happening. But simultaneously, exactly the same thing is happening in all the other sarcomeres of that long freight train, that myofibril. So all of those tiny amount of shortenings add up to quite a bit of shortening, and the whole muscle gets drastically shorter, which allows you to move a limb, for instance. All right? So that's how they work, but that's not always happening. We need to talk about when it is allowed to happen. First, though, let's go to slide 12. This is just showing you how a myosin thick filament is built. It takes many individual myosin molecules bundled together, but a single myosin molecule has... it's kind of a golf club shape. So it has a long shaft, and then it has a head called the myosin head that looks just like the head of a driver that is at an angle with respect to the shaft, just like on a golf driver. Unlike a golf driver, though, that angle can change. And that's the essence of these things operating as motor proteins. The myosin head angle with respect to the shaft can change. And if it does so, while that myosin head is connected to something, which would be actin, that actin gets drug along for the ride. All right? Now obviously, this is going to be an active process. It's going to require ATP, right? But that's what happens molecularly. And the reason that the heads are situated in opposite directions at the two ends of the myosin is because of what I said happens in a sarcomere. This whole myosin filament is centered on the M line. It doesn't move, really. What moves are the actin thin filaments on one end toward the center this way, at the other end toward the center in the opposite way, pulling the two Z discs together. All right, that was a thick filament. Now let's go to 13 and look at a thin filament. Like I said, the thin filament is much thinner, but it's actually made up of multiple proteins, whereas myosin is the only thing in a thick filament. Thin filaments, though, are often called actin filaments because the thing that really makes it a filament for its entire length is the actin part. So that's one type of protein. Now, we talked about actin in the cytoskeletal chapter. And actin, there is what is called G-actin and there is F-actin. I mentioned these, didn't I, already? What does the G stand for? Globular. Right. So a single G-actin monomer is one bead on this filament that looks like a string of beads. F-actin, that's called that because that means filamentous. So it takes many G-actins hooked end-to-end to make one F-actin. And F-actin, several F-actins are then helically combined, as you see here, to form the overall thickness of the thin strand and the whole length of it. That's one type of protein. Another kind, shown in green here, is tropomyosin. All right? tropomyosin isn't as long as F-actin. So we're seeing this green thing is one tropomyosin. This one's a separate one. And then if you went down the whole length of it, not the whole length of this is shown, the F-actin would be much, much longer, but you'd have many tropomyosins along the length of it. Now notice the relationship, this is the important way this works, the relationship spatially between tropomyosin in green and the actin in blue. Notice that it kind of spirals around the F-actin surface. This is important because what tropomyosin is doing while your muscle is at rest is covering the individual myosin binding sites on each G-actin bead of that F-actin strand. You don't really see the active sites here because they're covered. But on the cartoon version at the bottom, each individual G-actin, which is one blue bead, has on its surface a binding site where a myosin head can make a cross bridge, as it's called. It connects to it. And the myosin heads, remember, are right here in the vicinity because there's thick filament right beside this thin filament. If the myosin binding sites of the G-actin are exposed, that myosin head will readily make a cross bridge. Tropomyosin doesn't allow that to happen, keeps it from happening, if it's in one of its two shapes. Its configuration, its conformation changes. But when it's in the conformation that it has when your brain is telling your muscles not to contract, when you're relaxing the muscle, it's in a position that covers all of these little myosin head, these myosin binding sites of the G-actins. All right? The tropomyosin is connected to the third major type of muscle involved in this thin filament. And that is called troponin. Now, troponin itself is made up of three different polypeptides, which is why they're labeled as TNT, TNI, and TNC. The TN stands for troponin, T-R-O-P-O-N-I-N. But there are three different kinds of polypeptides making it up. A single troponin molecule has itself three binding sites on it. One of those binding sites forms a bond with tropomyosin. Okay? That's the TNT part. The second T there stands for tropomyosin. A second binding site on the same troponin holds it onto or binds it to actin. Okay? So tropomyosin isn't actually directly bound to actin. Troponin is bound to both of them and therefore keeps them in their relationship. Those two are basically permanent binding. So the troponin is always bound to both the tropomyosin and to the actin. The third troponin binding site, which is not permanent, it goes back and forth, is a binding site for calcium ion. And calcium ion serves as the signal that will actually allow the contraction to occur. All right? And I'll just finish by saying that the way that happens is if calcium ions are in the cytoplasm, which they normally aren't in a resting muscle, where do you find the calcium ions? Where? Right. In the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, which in a muscle cell happens to be called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but it's the same thing. Okay? The resting muscle actively pumps calcium ions into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, or the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So there isn't much calcium ion in the cytosol. When it gets released, when calcium gets released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it's now available to bind to troponin. When that happens, of course, there's going to be a shape change, right? And the shape change is such that the tropomyosin, which is also connected to the troponin, gets dragged out of the way, and that exposes all these binding sites for myosin heads. I'll continue next time.